Hello and welcome to another Enable IQ Masterclass. My guest today is Sydney Swans legend, Josh Kennedy. Welcome, Josh.
Johnny, thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. And we're going to explore two main themes. One is this idea of treating what you do as a profession. So who better than a professional athlete to talk to us about it? And secondly, that idea of leadership. And Josh was a captain at Sydney Swans for a number of years. We're going to talk about how that shaped his career and how he's going to take it beyond that. Josh, thanks so much for joining us on Enable IQ Masterclass. Do you mind giving us a 30-second snapshot of who you are?
No worries. I grew up in Melbourne, family of a lot of AFL players around me, my cousins, my dad and grandfather played, but I moved up to Sydney at the end of 2009. I've been playing AFL football for 16 years. This is my 16th year as a professional athlete. Was fortunate enough to play in a premiership in 2012 with the Sydney Swans, and from 2017 to 2021, captained the side too, both solely and as a co-captain with Dane Rampey and Luke Parker.
I want to explore that idea of being a sole captain versus a group captain at a moment, but you said your dad played and your grandfather played, but I think, you know, that's probably talking it down, isn't it? That they played at a pretty high level for quite a while?
Yeah, well, my dad played in four premierships with Hawthorn Football Club, and my grandfather coached Hawthorn's first three premierships, and is a Hall of Fame legend, I think, of the AFL.
Wow. Yeah. So I think in most people's cases, winning a premiership would be a great thing, and suddenly as a family, it doesn't look as impressive for you.
No, yeah, I'm a bit behind in the premiership stakes.
Yep. If you can just get four more in the next 4 years, I think you'll be fine.
That's right, yeah, yep, that's what we're aiming for.
Beautiful. How'd you get started in it?
Grew up in Victoria, in Melbourne. AFL footy's pretty big down there. Everyone at school plays it. I loved it. Obviously, I used to go with my dad. He was assistant coach for a number of years as well to go and watch the footy, but started just like anyone else in Auskick. And at school and went through the normal pathways as every other kid would.
Now, were you good immediately or did it take a while to click? How did that work for you?
I was always pretty good, but I was never really the an absolute standout, I don't think anyway. And, even to the point, I think in the under 16 representative side I missed out on. So I was always a good player, but probably not until later did I think I was really able to make it.
I think, and this is going to go out to a lot of executives, a lot of sales leaders and sales people, and your profession's a bit different to theirs because they start their profession in their early 20s or could be mid-20s or sometimes in their 30s, whereas, as an athlete, you're starting that profession in a way at 7 years old or 9 years old and working your way through. Yeah. Was there ever a moment for you where it clicked, either as an amateur and junior or as a professional, where you thought, okay, now I've got it?
I think the moment for me was probably when I did miss out, as I mentioned, that under 16 representative side. It was just, and it wasn't like the end of the world or anything like that. Football was always something fun. It was never too much pressure. Yep. I placed on myself or any external pressure. But at that moment in time, it sort of just made me sort of stop and think, okay, what is it that I need to do better to become better? Like let's have a look at my game and where can I improve? How can I do that? And it was probably that was the point when things changed in terms of looking at it from just a pure enjoyment thing and yeah. to if this is something I want to have a crack at, then I probably need to get a bit more specific about what I need to improve on as a player.
It's pretty mature of you as a 16-year-old to be able to think that way because, we try and train and coach executives to do this all the time of reflecting back on what could I do better, how could I improve, but also what do I already do really well? So you keep doing that as well. So I think as a 16-year-old, it's good thinking. Do you keep doing that now as a professional?
Yeah, absolutely. I think even more so as time goes on, I think that's the nature of being a professional athlete is you're always constantly looking for ways to improve. And you know, every off season comes around at the end of it. I mean, our whole week and season is around performance, review, preview, performance, review, preview. So you're constantly analysing yourself.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. But that's a week to week basis. But I guess at the end of a season, you sort of look back and you go, okay, how was it? Where am I going to sort of, again, focus my energy in this off season? Where can I get an extra 1-2% to be better? Because there's always constant, you know, there's kids coming in every year that are trying to knock you off. And, you know, there's such a huge talent pool out there that to try and stay at the best, you've got to try and keep improving. So it's something that's, that's always front of mind.
Yeah, I like that idea though of, you know, performance and then review. And what was the third one?
Preview.
Preview.
Like, so you sort of set goals, you train, you perform, and then you review it.
Brilliant.
You do it or you haven't.
And I suppose there's the video sessions that you do on a regular basis.
Yeah, that's all part of it. Again, it just becomes sort of second nature that you set the goal for the week. As a team, you go out, and as an individual, as a team, you go out and you play, and then you sit back and you go, well, did I tick off the things that I wanted to do this week? Yes or no? If yes, well done. What are we going to focus on next week? If no, why not? What do we need to change? What perhaps in my preparation did I do wrong, or was it a mindset? And let's attack it again for next week.
It's interesting. Years ago, I ran a sales team and they had a pretty distinct presentation that they would use on a regular basis. And I used to get them because they were too big a team for me to spend every week with them going through their presentation. I had video cameras in the different offices and they had to film their presentation every week.
Yeah.
And we would keep always their best ever sales weeks. We'd keep videos of that. And then we'd keep potentially ones that they'd had a few struggles and things that they'd overcome. And what we found is if they were ever doing two or three poor weeks in a row, we'd get them to just watch what it was like when they were on.
Yeah.
And it was interesting that it wasn't something huge they were doing differently. It might've just been their energy. It might have just been their mindset. Yeah, but you could pick it up instantly on the video within a few minutes of that.
Yeah.
And so that idea of reviewing, it's probably not something I think done enough in the corporate space. You know, we have our sales meeting and things like that, but often we're talking about what are we going to do next week? But are we ever checking in on, did we actually do what we said we were going to do?
Yeah, I agree. And in the time I've spent in the corporate space over my career, it's that, and the probably the biggest difference is just the constant feedback that you're given as a professional athlete. From, you know, there's so many different avenues from, you know, analytics around your GPS, how far you've ran, how fast, comparatively to previous weeks. But yeah, just that idea of reviewing constantly of what you've done and that feedback from your teammates or in corporate world, your co-workers or your boss, as in your coach, and constantly understanding where you stand and where, you know, what's expected from you.
Do you think as well, and I'm probably assuming a bit here, because you're getting so much feedback as an athlete, you don't take it as personally? Whereas I think a lot of our clients in the corporate space, they take feedback on as though it's them personally as opposed to their performance, what they're doing. And so therefore, there's a reluctance to be providing that ongoing feedback and regular feedback.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's hard not to take it personally, even as a professional athlete, but in terms of how you frame it with regards to, you know, people think of feedback as, oh shit, you know, what am I doing wrong? Yeah. You know, maybe they're not liking what I'm doing, but how you frame it in terms of, look, this is just part of the process for us to get better, for you to get better, and us to get better. And we're doing this because as a team, we want to be better and we want you to get the best out of yourself. And if I'm not giving you the feedback as a player, as a teammate, and I just sort of let you go through the motions, then I'm doing you a disservice because it comes halfway through the season and you're getting dropped or you're not getting a game and you don't know why. You want to know why.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I've had a bad game, I certainly take it personally.
Yeah, okay.
But the feedback is there. It's, or the review process or the criticism is not personal because it's, everyone wants the same outcome as for me to be better and thus the team to be better.
In another masterclass, we interviewed a gentleman by the name of Mike Wilson, and he runs a charity called JDRF. Order of Australia medal. And he talked about in his career this shift, and he's been a CEO for a number of years, but it was actually one of his team members who doesn't report to him, who was at a two or three levels below, who came in one day and said, "Mike, do you mind if I give you some feedback?"
He said, really?
"The way you delivered this made me and others feel a certain way, and I think you could do it differently." And he said that it was a bit of an aha moment for him because, one, that someone was brave enough to come in and provide that feedback and how much he learned from it. And he says he made some significant shifts, but he gives more feedback as a result, but he asks for more feedback as a result. And I thought that was a pretty good learning. I'm fortunate because I've got some people I work with who love giving me feedback on a regular basis. So I'm constantly being told what I'm doing well, but also some areas I need to improve as well. And you're right, it is challenging not to take things personally, especially if you're competitive. But it's also going to be challenging to ever get better if you're not understanding how you can get better.
Yep.
So I think there's got to be some onus on accepting feedback well, but I think, as you said, the people providing the feedback must be able to do it in a way as well that's, I hate the word constructive, but, you know, it's framed on the action, the impression, rather than, you know, you're doing this, so to speak.
Again, I think it just comes back to your relationship with the feedback and how you perceive it in your mind, whether it's constructive or negative. And I think the idea of a business or a team is to create the environment where the feedback is not necessarily looked upon as a negative thing. It's just, it is what we do, and it's for all of us to get better. And, you know, it's actually, you prefer to know where you stand or know things that you're doing well and things that you can improve on, rather than just sort of float through and, you know, come the end of this season or even the end of your career and it's just gone like that and you couldn't do anything about it.
So I'm going to pause this and we will touch on it soon, but this idea of a makeup of a team, I really, you know, we've had conversations before about this and it's something I'm genuinely interested in. I think what you've got to share is going to be phenomenal, but I want to touch on two things first. One is, you've mentioned your corporate executive career and so you've spent a bit of time and gone into different corporations. Do you want to give us a quick update on what you've been doing the last few years?
The last few years have been a bit difficult given the COVID situation, been a bit of a write-off, but I've had the fortunate experience to be able to spend time with different companies and you know, recently, or the last 5 years, one in particular, Wilson Asset Management, who have had the benefit of, you know, being mentored by some great people there, Chris Stott when he was there, Oscar Oberg, Kate Thorley and Jeff Wilson, obviously. Spent a bit of time with a startup digital bank called Vault Bank, which hopefully launching pretty soon to the broader market, but it was an amazing journey to see them sort of, I think my first day was when they got their restricted banking license, the first first sort of startup bank since the 80s to get that and see their journey go from startup and 30 people working to now over 100 you know, there's still a lot of challenges, but it's see their vision sort of come to reality. And, you know, a few other bits and pieces along the way, but they're probably the two main ones over the last few years.
So great to hear you've been doing that. I'm curious, what's the driver behind it? You don't have to obviously work. You're getting paid to be an athlete. You work pretty hard from what I've seen of your schedule. So what was the driver behind wanting to get that work experience?
Number one is that I'm an athlete. You know, it's a finite amount of time that I can do what I'm doing.
You're not going to play forever?
Can't play forever, forever, unfortunately. You know, it's not like over in the States or in Europe, the soccer leagues where you're getting paid multiple millions of dollars. So
you don't have a private jet yet?
That's right. Yeah, not Cristiano Ronaldo. But that's something that, as a professional athlete in Australia, with all of the sports, and specifically AFL, and something that was drummed into me pretty early was just make sure you've got something outside of football that you're interested in. It takes my mind off it, adds a bit of balance to my life, and yeah, it's also something that, you know, you have to think about, is that my career's going to end at some point. Yeah. I'm 33, 34 this year. Certainly coming towards the back end. You know, I'm not going to be retired now and be able to sail into the sunset and then do something else.
I think, and I'm fortunate in my role that I get to meet a lot of successful people. And I think, you know, you probably, when you were doing that at the peak of your earning power, you know, within AFL, and just the foresight to think about it 6 or 7 years ago, not towards the end of your career. Like, I understand people often do it at 30, 31, 32, but for you to do that in your mid-20s and late-20s, I think it's a lot of foresight. And I think I see it in people who are top performers. There's a level of intent about things that they do. You're like, there's always this idea of intention, thought. You're almost, the way they walk, the way they speak, the way they think is about it. And I think that's what I've taken from you with that corporate space. It's a level of intent about, you know, where you want to go, what you want to do, and what life could look like over the long term.
Yeah, I've been pretty fortunate as well with my support network, family and friends. As I said, it's something that's always been drummed into me, even when I was at school, making sure that was number one priority. And, you know, because you just don't know, you know, not many, I don't know what the percentage of players that get drafted and then play a game, it wouldn't be very high. So make sure you've always got something to fall back on.
So let's quickly go back to then, from a professional standpoint. You got drafted straight out of school?
Yes.
Yep. Yep. And you went straight to Hawthorn because of, is it the father-son rule?
So I got drafted sort of halfway through my final year of school. To Hawthorn through the father-son rule. So that was, you know, I was pretty fortunate in the fact that I knew that I was getting drafted. I knew where I was going. Yep. I was staying in Victoria with the family. It was a great experience. Hawthorn at the time had, you know, they were on the rise. Alistair Clarkson at the helm. They won their first premiership under him in 2008. My first year was 2007. So I was there for 2007, 8, 9, 3 years. Played 13 games. I think I didn't play any my first year, 3 in my second and 10 in my last.
Okay.
But at the time, they just had a lot of players that were at the peak of their powers in my position. So opportunities were fleeting. And at the end of 2009, Sydney Swans, which was a bit of a surprise, came knocking on the door and said, you know, we'd be interested to potentially get you up to Sydney. What do you think? I told Alistair Clarkson this, and he sort of gave me the blessing and said, yeah, look, I think it's a good opportunity. You'd be silly not to take it. So I took it.
I think that what I was hoping to derive from this anyway, and I hope people get this, is that you've played, I think we said before, 287 games now.
Yeah.
And 13 in your first 3 years.
Yep.
And I think when you hear someone playing, you know, close to 300, which is a big mark, you just expect it clicked early, right? And suddenly they were playing AFL from the first game and didn't stop. But for 3 years, you really had to ply your craft and get better and better and before it, you know, fully clicked and that opportunity came.
Yeah, halfway through 2009, I was, you know, I'm sort of thinking, geez, what am I going to do next year? Because this whole career path of AFL football is probably going to come to an end. You know, what I've learned through that experience was how quickly, number one, things can change, and how much, I guess, because when I got to the Hawthorn, and I think the people would attest that were there, that I was doing everything right.
Yep.
Everything that was expected of me, and I was just doing everything that was expected. But probably, when I went to Sydney, it was like, righto, well, I've got this opportunity now, a new one. I'm going to do everything right, but I want to do it. I want to be really specific about myself and be a little bit selfish initially in terms of what do I need to do to play here and get a game. And I want to be knocking on the coach's door, and I want to be seeking that feedback constantly.
Yeah.
So that, that's the other thing with feedback, is that if you're constantly asking for feedback from a boss or a coach, it's that sort of squeaky door mentality that gets fixed. They're constantly giving it to you.
Yeah.
you're sort of annoying them in a way, but they're like, well, this kid just wants to get better. They want to learn, they want to get better, and ended up being a self-fulfilling prophecy in the end.
I want to hijack this because this idea of feedback, you've got to, as you said, you've got to want it and ask for it. And I think if someone's difficult to give feedback with too, then you're reluctant to continue to give them feedback. Yeah. I've done coaching sessions with someone where literally it feels like you're interrogating them by asking them, tell me a bit about your role. And so a simple question like that, but they're so nervous about getting some form of feedback or someone seeing in. So I think that's really positive, but I'm going to relate it to conversations I have with salespeople, either early in their career when they want promotions or even leaders who see themselves better. And so often they want to tell everyone how good they are and what they've done, as opposed to this idea of, I'd love an opportunity. How do I get better? What do you need to see from me? How could I do this? Can you come watch? You know, it's that idea of, yep. You know, how do we actually take this desire and intent and improve yourself, as opposed to how does the organisation prove to me that they can, you know, do something for me? Does that make sense what I'm getting?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it sounds like you did that. You were able to actually drive that, how do I help get the organisation selfishly to make me better? And therefore, that's going to help the team.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm under no illusion either. There's an element of luck and, you know, sometimes all it is as well is just that the opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, Sydney gave me the opportunity. You know, I remember Paul Roos coming to my house before the trade went through after the season, but when I first heard that Swans were interested, sat down there at the kitchen table and you know, basically telling me, Josh, you know, if you come to Sydney, we see a spot for you and it'd be yours to lose. So we're going to play you and you either play your way into the team or you keep your spot or you play your way out, meaning, you know, it's there, it's yours, and we'll give you the opportunity, we'll back you in, and then it's up to you whether or not you hold on to it. So,
it's powerful, isn't it?
That is powerful, yeah. The confidence that gave me and the drive to be able to go, everything I did from then on, I knew, well, you know, if I get a little bit faster, if I get a little bit fitter, if I get a little bit stronger, it's going to translate into, you know, me being able to perform better and it's going to be seen and recognised.
I find that interesting because I had a mentor and it's an old saying and it said that luck is where preparedness meets opportunity. And I think your example is so perfect for that because you needed the opportunity and you were starting to doubt whether or not you were ever going to get that opportunity. But the work you'd done in the 3 years leading up to it, that you were trying to get fitter, stronger, faster, every aspect to it allowed you to be prepared for the opportunity when you got it, yep. As opposed to head down, kicking stones, cutting corners. When you got that opportunity, you probably wouldn't have been ready to play.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. And it came down to internal belief too. So yeah. I played the back end of 2009 because Hawthorn had a fair few injuries. And I just, that gave me the confidence to know that I could compete at the AFL level. Yeah. So from then it was all systems go.
And it's such a good way of thinking of, you know, 13-3, you get the opportunity, 287 games. You're now, is it the leader in history of contested possessions?
Yeah, I am currently, as of the weekend.
As of the weekend? Okay. So that extra contested possession went in your favour, is that right?
Yes.
But, you know, we're talking about legends of the game, and I'm not doing this to embarrass you, but I think you mentioned Patrick Dangerfield's there, Gary Ablett Jr., you know, is up there with that as well. And again, I'm more saying this for that idea of the people watching, that idea of betterment, that constantly wanting to get better, that reviewing, that performing, you know,
yeah.
You know, it's that idea of continually wanting to improve and get better. And it's something that we talk about a lot here at Enable IQ, is that just constant getting better, get better, get better, keep improving.
Yeah, so I think with, you know, certainly with me over the course of my career, and I think it'd be the same for a lot of people, I don't think it's everyone, and I think it'd be the same with, you know, high-level executives as well, is that there's also that there's that constant sort of element of it's like an anxiety that you know that, you know, I've seen the benefit of how quickly things can turn in a positive sense.
Yep.
through my own personal development, but through other people's as well, how much it can turn the other way too.
Yeah.
You know, and in work and certainly in sport, you know, you get a little bit ahead of yourself and bang, it just, we call it the great leveler. It'll just bring you back down to earth really quickly. And so, again, it's same with the feedback, same with everything. It's just that how you, your relationship with that, because it can eat away at you. Like it's one of those things that's hard to explain to people, because the jobs on a whole, it's great. It's great because, you know, you get 8 weeks off, 10 weeks off a year, you know, your time off during the week. Like it's, from the outside looking in, it's the best job in the world, which it is. Yeah. But the part that I find hard to explain is that just that constant, where you're all constantly thinking about it in the back of your mind, that if I eat this or I take this shortcut, it's going to come back to bite me. So, that's something that I think it's ingrained in me.
Yeah.
But it's also helped me, again, my relationship with it is that that's a good thing, because it's helped me stay on edge and helped me wanting to be better and understand that I've got to keep trying to improve, otherwise I'm going backwards.
I like that. When I was younger, I had we used to have all these affirmations on the wall, and I read this. It was a really crude one. I think it was an ex-triathlete, but it was a business book I read, and it said, while you're sleeping, someone out there is training, improving while you're sleeping. And they said, when you meet them, they will beat you. And
I just love that.
I just love that terminology of they'll beat you. It's just so to the point. And apart from I'm getting a bit disappointed in your 8 to 10 weeks holiday, because now I'm in startup mode, holidays are a thing of the past. But we work in a really competitive environment.
Yeah.
But we truly believe that we're the best offering in what we do.
Yeah.
But it's not about believing it yourself. It's about getting others to believe it. And I suppose in your business, it's the same, isn't it? You can have confidence in you as a player, but you need your teammates and you need your coaches and you need probably the media as well to believe in you as well.
Yeah, I mean, inevitably, the media's, you take that away from it. Yeah, you need, number one, yourself and then your teammates. And, you know, the art of a good culture, I think, is if you know what's required of you to earn that trust and respect from your teammates. If you're doing that, then you've got it. Whereas if you're going into a footy club and you don't know what that is, then I reckon that's where it can break down a fair bit. But and there's a lot of those, you know, that saying, I've definitely heard that saying as well. You know, that's pretty extreme.
So,
you know, you can't train all the time.
No.
But you've got to, it's just that you know what you need to do.
Yeah.
I know what I need to do. I know I'm every year, every pre-season, I'm looking to improve.
Yeah.
Every season, I'm looking to improve in some way. It might just be, I might need to lose a kilo just to be able to cover the ground a bit
more. I was
going to
say something.
Or I might need to, I want to just work on my explosiveness. I want to be a bit quicker. And I might not get quicker, but I might just maintain my speed, you know? It might be something like that you're just focusing on to
I think what I'm driving towards is because you train so much to play, that ratio, right, where you train 5-6 days a week and you play once, you play 25, 30 games a year, ideally, if you're playing semis and so on, but you train so much to be able to perform.
Yeah.
Whereas in exec mode, you're playing all the time. And what we're trying to do when we talk about this idea of betterment is that if you could put a percentage of your time aside to be improving, a percentage of your time, whether it be through coaching, whether it be through role play, whether it be through learning, and obviously we're a bit biased because we have a learning platform that we expect people to use and think it's going to improve them. But I think you need to take that from this is that, you know, you've got a 30-year career ahead of you in the corporate world. Are you any better 20 years in than you were 10? Are you any better 25 years than you were 15? In a lot of cases, and in some cases, they're not. They haven't done anything apart from be more experienced, so to speak, because they haven't taken on feedback or they haven't asked for it and they haven't sought out how to get better and improve.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if it was me personally, the experience factor is the best form of learning.
Yeah.
Only though, if during that time, because during that time you are able to review, you're able to sit back and just go, okay, well, how did that week go? How did that meeting go? Like we do it in as a leadership group, you go, well, how was training this week? And to be able to better yourself, you have to actually take learnings from those experiences. So if you just go through those experiences, you don't actually reflect on them and take the time to sit back and go, well, what did we do well? What got us through? What can we do better next time? Then, yeah, you're right. You're sort of just going through the motions and you'll probably make the same mistakes again. And I guess for us, it's a constant thing because, and we have to, again, the footy season, it just becomes such it's so monotonous in terms of it's you play, you recover, you train, you prepare, you play, you recover, you train, you prepare. But, you know, 5 weeks go by and like that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's the same anywhere. But you do have to be diligent in being able to take the time to reflect and go, okay, how was, as a leadership group, we have to, how was training this week? Was our energy up? Did we do what we needed to do? What have we let slip in terms of, you know, some drills or some team thematics that we haven't spoken about in a few weeks and bang, it's come back to bite us on the weekend. And being able to take the time to reflect and review your own performance and that of the team, I think is the most important thing to be able to then take the learnings, and that's where the experience actually matters, I reckon.
Yeah, okay. So again, for the people watching who run teams, I think it's critical that they're taking what great sporting teams and professional organisations use, and how do we make sure we're constantly reviewing as a group, as a team, but also individually, so they can keep improving. I get this feeling though, the idea of not wanting to improve wouldn't work within your culture anyway at the Swans. And so we might use this as a bit of a segue. You were a player for a number of years and then you became captain.
Yep.
Tell me how that changed for you and potentially, you know, you were part of two different cultures within the Swans and how that shifted.
In terms of two different cultures?
Well, I suppose when I say cultures, that's probably a bit harsh. I mean more that idea of you made a decision as a group at some point to be able to build, or maybe you didn't, sorry, but the group decided to build a particular culture and the players really took ownership of that. And I think that I found it fascinating.
Yeah.
And when we had a conversation around it, I took a whole bunch of notes off the back of it and really, I'd love people to be able to hear and see what that experience was like.
Yeah, well, I guess the change in culture was happened before I arrived to the Swans in 2003, where they decided that, or they developed this sort of Bloods culture. They developed a trademark that was run and driven purely by the playing group, supported by the coaches, supported by the board, supported by everyone within the club, which is really important, but it was driven by the playing group. And that's still is going on today. And I think, you know, that group of players would be really proud coming back into the footy club and seeing it still vibrant and alive. And you know, that, you know, when I came to the Swans, one thing that was different to when I got to the Hawks was this sort of sense of induction. So when I got to the Hawks, and, you know, they've been an amazing club. They're a fantastic club. They've got a winning culture, they're great. But I sort of came in, just went about my business, trying to do everything that I could right. But when I got to the Swans, I immediately felt like I was sort of back in playing for my school footy team. It's the fact that it was you know, that sort of real team cohesiveness. Well, you know, we had an induction night when I first got there, which was run by the players. It was really special, something that I really look forward to and enjoy doing as a leader, as a captain now. And that sort of sense of, okay, well, you're here, you're one of us now, you're one of us.
Yeah.
And this is what we require from you as a person, not as a player, but as a person, in how you go about the things. And if you do that, you're gonna be here for a while, and you're gonna earn the respect of everyone else around you. Yeah, so that idea of how do you maintain the culture, you know, one thing is, yep, we have the induction night, you know, these are behaviours that are required. You know, you can either behave your way in or behave your way out. A bit like what Rosie said, this is your spot, it's yours to lose. This is your team, you're in here, it's yours to lose. We're not gonna, you know, you're one of us, but you can easily behave your way out if you don't abide or follow the values that we believe are essential to be a
responsible. I actually love that terminology, behave your way out.
Yeah.
It's such a good way of putting it, isn't it?
And so, you know, that's all great and said and done, and then you leave the the induction, you're feeling great, and you're feeling, how good's this? But to be able to actually maintain it, the most important thing is then that the leadership group drive those standards. So from then on, it's okay, well, if someone's late for training, if someone's missed something that they needed to do, we're going to go down to Maroubra Beach and do a 6 a.m. and do a punishment session. We call it the knuckle session, punishment session. Yeah. I remember the first one we did. I went down to Maroubra at 6 a.m. because someone might have been late for training or missed something. So the whole team goes down.
So one player misses.
And
then the leadership group decides.
Yeah, this is during the pre-season. Then we're like, right, nah, bang, we've got to get on top of that quick. One in, all in. Let's go down. We're down there and we're down on doing push-ups down at Maroubra Beach on the concrete. There's push-ups onto your knuckles.
Yeah.
And then hand, palms, knuckles, they call it palms, knuckles, and they do three rounds. By the end of it, everyone's knuckles have got calluses built up, most of them bleeding, everyone's in pain.
Imagine the media saying that all the Swans players have been in fights lately. They've just said,
that's right. That's
knuckles are bleeding.
But I remember leaving that first one and thinking, how good's that? I actually enjoyed it. I don't know why, but I remember speaking to Dad and going, someone missed that. So we're all down there and boys were calling out and everyone's sort of encouraging everyone to, keep at it, push through. That's, again, that coming, circling back to maintaining, it's just all about being critical and hard on behaviours that are not aligned with the values, but fair.
Yeah.
But also the flip side of that is it's not just all about whacking guys with a stick if they do it wrong. It's also rewarding the behaviour that do align with it and putting that up in lights and celebrating and acknowledging growth, and I think in an organisation that's just as important too, is if someone's doing a great job, but just acknowledging it.
Yeah.
And I think, as you can certainly take it for granted. Once you're into the swing of things and the weeks are going by and people are just ticking it off and doing their job and they're doing it well, and you just sort of take it for granted that's how it's meant to be. But
it seems as though the group takes full ownership of the process. It's that idea, we often use that term, trust the process. Like the result will take care of itself if you do everything else right. But just that example means the group itself is saying that we're going to take ownership of the process. That if we're cutting corners, we know that the result's not going to get the optimal outcome. So therefore we need to make sure that the process is done right. Yeah. And again, I just think of what a powerful example to teams out there that, you don't have to be at Maroubra Beach doing palms and knuckles, although it'd be pretty good for the team. But it is that idea of, well, what do we stand for? And if we truly stand for it, why are these standards getting dropped?
That's exactly right, yeah. And that's not to say that standards don't drop, because they do. I mean, there's times where, but that's, I guess that comes back to the point of just having to be able to take a step back in certain times and just go, how are we going? How's training been? Who are the players at the moment that deserve, who is going really well? And we need to acknowledge that they're going really well and they're doing everything right and they should be, we want to put them up in lights and celebrate what they've done. And who's probably a bit at risk at the moment? Who's, just that time. And it's not easy. Well, certainly what I've learned from a leadership point of view and as captain is that it's certainly not easy.
Yeah.
It's bloody hard, and it's not hard in the fact that what you have to do isn't necessarily hard. You have to do more, but it's just that you have to be constantly thinking big picture and outside yourself, and I think reflecting on things and within your leadership team or your team. Just constantly reflecting and go, what can we do better? What's worked well? Who's been doing well? Who needs a little bit of feedback?
So let's quantify some of this. What are some of the leadership learnings that you could touch on?
Well, I think when I first took over as captain, I had these four players who sort of encapsulated all the aspects of leadership that I wanted to aspire to. They were, you know, Brett Kirk, Adam Goods, Reece Shaw, who wasn't a captain but he was a leader, and Joe McVeigh. So Kirky was someone that was just so passionate, still is, he still works at the club, but extremely passionate, you know. Got to, you know, spread the love was his thing, you know. Loved his teammates, was passionate when he spoke. The Bloods, you know, it was his footy club. Goodsy was someone that had every right to sort of put himself on a pedestal, put himself first at times, but never did. It was always team, team, team. So in terms of him, it was just no ego, you know. If the team's going well, the team's going well.
Okay.
If the team's going poorly, it's on us.
Okay.
But so that idea with Goodsy. With Reece Shaw, it was that relationship piece. He was someone that just could connect to everyone, whether it was the CEO, the 300 game players, or the people that have just walked into the footy club, could just connect on their level and immediately have built a relationship where he could communicate with them. And then Jared McVeigh was someone that was just hard. He was just black and white, bang. You know, there comes a time where this is not on, bang, let's come down hard on this person. You're not, at the moment, I think you're selfish, I think this. He wouldn't hold back in okay. calling that out. But what I quickly learnt was that, you know, I definitely couldn't be all of those things. Yeah. And I think I tried to be early days, but I couldn't be. And so, you know, in terms of the key learnings, it was, number one, understand who I am.
Yeah.
And the assets that I had as a leader, as a player, understand where my flaws were. And in understanding that, then it became, I could, you know, ask help the leadership group and the people around me that I knew were, if it was a relationship thing, I knew that Dane Rampey was someone that, you know, similar to Reece Shaw, that could connect with anyone and just had a deep relationship. So I go, mate, you know, can you get to this player? And just understanding your strengths and weaknesses and then being able to surround yourself with people that complement you was something that I reckon I've learned along the journey. I think that tough love piece as well, like it's really hard to, especially in a team environment where I found it really hard to be hard on people. But again, that came with building the expectations early. So when players come in and an induction, building their expectations of this is what it is, this is what we do, and this is how we do it, and this is why we do it. It's to make you better, it's to make us better. Inevitably, everyone's going to be better for it. If
you frame it right, they'd almost expect it, wouldn't they? You know, like if they're cutting a corner, they're expecting to be picked up on it because you've told them up front.
Yes.
And so I would assume that by the third or fourth time you've given that feedback,
yep.
You know, they know pretty clearly it's coming.
Yeah, that's right. And it's important as well to, in that environment, to hold yourselves accountable. So first and foremost, there's no point in a first year kid that's come in that's, you know, that lacks a bit of intensity or something, just going after him.
Yeah.
You need to be able to put myself on the chopping block, not, you know, being caught, because I'm certainly not perfect. Everyone in the team makes mistakes, and just making sure that they see that it's normal for myself to give Dane Rampey or Luke Parker feedback or Kieran Jack and vice versa to me, and that we don't walk out of the room, the team meeting after that, hating each other, and we can shake hands, we can train, and we can, you know, we're still mates.
Yeah, that's right. We often get asked or get given feedback on leaders or a group before we work with them, and we always say it's okay, we'll make up our own minds. Like, we don't want your opinion on what we think.
Yeah.
And we often hear this terminology of, Josh, he doesn't take feedback well. And we always ask the question first, how do you deliver the feedback?
Yeah.
Like actually some ownership of how we're providing feedback, because if you do it the wrong way, you will get a poor reaction.
Yeah.
Right? And so again, it sounds like you frame these conversations really well up front. You pick people up on things regularly, so it's not one-off. But then you've got that openness post that conversation where, again, you're shaking hands, you're still having conversations. It's nothing personal, and it's the work you do kind of leading, during and post, yep, as opposed to perfecting the one bit of feedback.
Absolutely, yep. The one bit of feedback's almost the, if you can, that, like, the work pre,
yep,
makes that easier, and then the post makes it, almost ingrains it. And that's more important than when the follow-up post the feedback. If you just tell someone, mate, I don't think you're training hard enough. I think your standards aren't high enough. I think you've got a lot more to give, and just walk away and don't speak to that person again, then that's when it breaks down. You need to then be able to follow it up. 2 days' time, 3 days' time, mate, I think I've noticed an improvement. You know, that should be the benchmark. See if you can keep it at that level. I've noticed it 2-3 weeks go by, it's still there. And the player's form's gone up, bam, that's gold, because you, for the rest of the team too, you go, well, look, you know, so-and-so's had this feedback, they've implemented this plan, and they haven't just done it for 1 or 2 days or 1 week or 2 weeks, they've done it every day or every week for 3-4 weeks, yeah, okay, and they're just seeing the reward now. But it's through a certain amount of work that's been put behind the scenes. That,
So I really love that idea of you were trying to be everything. And just hearing you speak to that, I think of a number of leaders that we work with who would probably get a lot from that, but just me personally as well. And I think what often holds corporates back, if I say, or executives, is this, ego's maybe too harsh a term, but it's almost this competitive environment. So the idea of getting somebody else to come in and deal with a certain task within your team, or potentially a senior person within, if they're great at something. You know, it's that idea of it's not done as often within a corporate environment, whereas I believe that if it can work in professional sport where you're on actual time-based contracts,
yeah,
it can work in a corporate environment. Is that fair?
In terms of the...
I suppose bringing others in from a leadership position to be able to do things that you're not necessarily strong at or don't have time to, you know, you believe they could do it better than you?
I think for us, what's the end goal? It's to win a premiership, you know, it's so clear. I'd prefer to be not even a leader of a team that wins a premiership rather than the captain of a team that doesn't make finals every year.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, there's no better culture than a winning culture. In business, in anything.
Well, you're clear on the outcome you're looking to achieve.
Yes.
Like, there's no grey, is there? We're here to win a premiership.
Correct.
And I suppose what I'm getting at, to be clearer with it, is you as a captain don't see your position being lessened by bringing leaders in to do things you're not strong at.
No.
Whereas,
yeah,
often in the corporate space, we often see leaders reluctant to bring others in because it might question their leadership. And I think that's the bit that I'm taking from it that we could potentially get others to learn from, is this, that idea of you actually, you know, heighten yourself and grow yourself by bringing in other leaders to be able to do aspects that, you know, that awareness piece.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, to answer that question more directly is, you know, as a leadership group or as a captain or as a leadership group, you know, our role is to, number one, live and breathe the standards, to drive them, you know, reward the good behaviours and try and, you know, be hard on the behaviours that don't align with the culture. But also, and a big part of it is to develop the next batch of leaders. And, you know, what I've learned over the time as well is that the more players that you can have in the team that could potentially be leaders, the better the team's going to be. And I think from even from my captaincy point of view, so I was sole captain for 2 years. 2 years? 2 years sole captain, and then Dane and Luke Parker joined me for the next 3 or 4 years. which historically the Sydney Swans have had co-captains,
yes,
pretty much right the way through. And again, in putting the ego to the side, number one, it made us better as a leadership group. Number two, it took a lot of pressure off me just personally, as a captain, and it spread that load. And number three, again, it made me realise how, you know, well, geez, Dane's really good at this, Luke's really good at this, and together we complement each other pretty well. So from a team perspective, I think it just brought everyone up a level. So by them coming on board and helping me, it made me better, it made them better, it made other leaders within the team better and made us better as a team.
Which has put you in a good position now, isn't it? Because you have a number of leaders that have come through.
Yeah. Well, it's still happening now. Even, you know, I'm not captain this year. That was decided by, you know, in conversations with John Longmire, the coach, that it was time for it to pass the baton on. And that's something that's, you know, again, always in the back of our mind. It's, you're given the baton, you run with it, you do what you can and try and make the place as good as possible and leave it in better than it was when you arrived. Try and do that, and then you pass the baton on. And for a leadership point of view and captaincy point of view, that was my time end of last year, to pass that on to Callum Mills, who, you know, you're watching him and you're seeing the qualities that he shows and develops, and you just go and you see the impact and influence that he has on the team and the rest of the playing group. And you just go, well, you know, it's time. You can tell that it's his time to take that, and it's been really good.
Wow. We've taken up a lot of your time, so I want to maybe just finish on one thing, if that's okay.
I feel like I'm just scratching the surface here.
I know. We might, if it's, you're open to it, even do a part two one day and bring you back, if that's okay. We'll keep pushing through this. But I remember from a conversation you sort of talked about with me, your first season as captain, if I've got the season right.
Yep.
And it all went perfectly, plain sailing, just won every game from the beginning, is that right?
Yeah, won every game from round seven. We lost our first six games. So we came, well, it was off the back of a grand final loss too in 2016. I think there was a fair bit of emotional fatigue after that. It's with a lot of our players, but I was handed the captaincy again by Jared and Kieran, who were still playing, part of the, you know, passing the baton on. But got off to a horrific start, being 0-6. No team, I think, in the history of the game had come back from 0-5 to make finals, and we were 0-6, and it sort of looked...
So I'm just imagining, though, you as a leader, you've gone from being in the top two teams in the competition, right? So you lost the grand final. So think of you as, you know, one of the best that exist. You now take over as captain, and you're none from six, and no one's ever made the semis or won the premiership after 0-6.
Yep.
How are you feeling as captain right now?
Oh, pretty small.
Yeah.
It was a tough time, but I was fortunate, again, with the support of the footy club, you know, friends and family, all that. But again, I think upon reflection is there was a few things that, you know, certainly having lost the grand final the year before, you know, my focus was when we get back to the grand final, I'm thinking about that already at the start of pre-season. I'm thinking grand final. We're getting back to the grand final and we're not losing the next one because we're going to do this. And my mind, I think of the team, was so far ahead in that space, you forget about, we took for granted the little things that we did day to day that made us a good team. And it wasn't a huge adjustment. It wasn't like we changed everything. Like there was times where, you know, after the third one where you might mix it up a little bit. But inevitably what it came down to is, okay, let's just strip it right back. What's our trademark? What do we want to be known as? Hard, Discipline United. What does that look like? Let's take the result out of it. You know, let's judge each other on just this week to week, and let's get after the opposition and support each other through that time. And again, it was really important as well. You know, I think one thing that I certainly didn't do was pass any blame or point any fingers or, you know, throw my hands up in the air and go, oh, this is too hard. I was proud of the fact that I could, you know, just stuck at it. And as a team and a leadership group, you know, the guys, yeah, and John Longmire, the confidence and support and the coaching staff instilled in the team through that time, because we're all going through the same thing. Everyone's got the same doubts and frustrations and things, you know, it's my fault, it's what am I doing wrong?
Yeah.
And to be able to sort of air that as well and come together, okay, what's made us a good side over many years? Let's just strip it right back and keep it pretty simple and let's just focus on that. And then that probably happened 2 weeks out from when we won our first game.
Okay.
But it was just that, okay, let's bang, we're doing that, let's do it again. Let's just focus on the basics, do extras. And once we won our first game, it was just, I remember that feeling so fatigued and tired, exhausted, yeah, but relieved.
Yeah.
And then it just, yeah, we won our next 13 of the next 15 games.
So you won 13 of your next 15 and actually made it to the semis?
Yep.
Yeah. Now, I want to just take this away. I find this really fascinating because having done this for a while now and working with groups, the amount of times that, you know, groups come up with values or come with standards, or we come up with, you know, get away in February and we go away and we come back. But I just love how you came back to it. And it was hard, disciplined.
United.
United. And you come back to the values, you come back to the standards, and you're saying, well, are we playing to those? Are we living these? Are we breathing them? And often when you go through a slump, I think we want to come up with something new, as opposed to, are we just living what we set out to?
Correct.
Are we actually doing what we said we're meant to be doing day to day? That idea of, you know, they talk about it, rituals or habits, you know, those aspects there. And I'm a big believer in those, but I think you take it to such a level that we can all just learn to simplify it and just come back to those aspects, and are we living them? And if we're not, and the second thing is we've got a few companies that, you know, they've got big targets that they're trying to hit, and they get to the end of the financial year or they get to the end of the calendar year and they hit their target, and then the next quarter is terrible because they're fatigued.
Yep.
And they forget the fact that they start at $1 the next
week. Yeah, it's hard.
And so it's that idea of mentally getting fatigued, because you know, you've just gone from the glory of being in a grand final, the agony of losing it, to then round one. You've got to play another game of footy, and you've got to win 15 more games to get into a semi-final to then get the chance to play in the next one, and so on. And I think it's again, you can't hit an annual target in 1 week, just like you can't win a premiership in 1 week.
Mm.
And so that idea of, and you know, if you're watching this and you're not taking from it that idea of just what are our standards and how do we live and breathe them, then I haven't done my job on making sure I've let you speak enough, because for me, I want to change some stuff that we're doing internally, but also, you know, pick up the phone this afternoon and speak to a bunch of my clients and talk about that idea of how do they come back to the real living and breathing of the basics of what they do, the fundamentals of what they stand for.
Yeah, absolutely. And the allocating time for reflection and revision and review of your processes, of how everyone's going. That's certainly something that, you know, and we have help with leading teams. I think they were the company that came on board that helped provide the facilitation of those discussions early days, and they've been with us a long time. But yeah, even now, there'd be times go by and someone would go, well, who's, you know, how's, let's have a look at the list and how's everyone going? Have we checked in with each other recently?
Yeah.
Oh, no, we haven't. No, thanks, you know. So that's where it becomes, it's easy, but it's hard because you're in the mud. You're going. You're playing, you're reflecting on your game. You're reviewing, you're trying to get better. So that ability just to, you know, put aside time and put it in the calendar and go, well, we're just going to, how did we go last week? How did we go last month?
I reckon it's easy to do once. It's easy to do every now and again.
Yep.
It's that ritual nature of doing it all the time.
Yeah.
With everything else that's going on. Everything else, yeah, it gets clouded. And it's an easy thing to drop off.
Yeah.
Those extra few phone calls, those extra few check-ins, the putting time aside to review, it's easy to not do.
Yeah.
And just, especially if you're winning.
Yeah.
Right? To say, well, everything's going okay. Yeah, yeah. You know, yeah. But obviously it's then again, those little bits get missed and then suddenly you're losing before you know it.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I've just thought of an example that's come to head my mind now. It's probably completely a bit left of field, but you know, just that that ability to reflect on and have the standards that you want to set. So, for example, that if a player's not playing well, he's had a few poor weeks, and you go and go, well, is he training hard? Yes. Is he doing his extras? Yes. So there's nothing on a process point of view that he's not doing. So it's not about being hard on this player. It's like, mate, you know, you're going all right. You're doing everything well. You know, it'll turn. And just acknowledging that rather than, there are some cases where he's just been floating through training.
Yeah.
He's probably, you know, I haven't seen him do extras. Then it's like, mate, you know, this is what we need to see from you. If you're doing that, we'll take the result out of it. But if you're doing that, at least you're showing us that you care and you want to improve.
I love that. I'm going to go really left center with an example, but many years ago I ran a direct sales team, and one of my top salespeople, like, he just went from a really good, consistent salesperson to he just couldn't make a sale. And I remember going and watching him on observation, and we're selling in people's homes, and I went and watched him, and he was doing everything right, except he'd lost confidence, so he was expecting a no. And I remember walking out and I said, oh, it's a mental thing. And he says, no, it's got to be more than that. There's got to be something.
Yeah.
And I said, well, there is. I just didn't want to bring it up. And I said, yeah, your sleeves are rolled up. And I said, it looks like you're not taking this seriously. And I think if you just went in with a crisp shirt tomorrow, if I'm honest with you, it'll make the difference in the world with you. And he put a crisp shirt on and he went in and he sold it and it wasn't a problem. And I completely made that up. It was I could tell as I was telling him it was a mental thing and it was a confidence. It wasn't enough for him. So I thought, I'll come up with something.
Yeah.
And it was just, he needed to have confidence going in that he could still make it work.
Yeah.
We're talking about a guy who's sold well for years and suddenly had two or three bad weeks, but he'd lost that confidence piece. And I think, again, it's caring enough to want to fix it. As you said, it's taking some kind of systematic approach to it as well.
Yeah,
and then also, and you talk to this a bit, is the person, the human, like what's going on for them that's actually halting performance.
Yes.
Right? So they're turning up for training, they're doing extras, but maybe they're just not as intense when they're there.
Yeah, or maybe they've got something else going on outside of football, and that's, again, that's part of the checking in. How's life? What's going on, you know? And that's something that I think, yeah, certainly myself, as a team, you can just let slip because you're so focused on the week-to-week ins and outs of trying to perform.
Okay, well, I think if you're open to it, I want to bring you back and talk even further on this, and we might just stick with leadership and teams if that's okay. But if I can think about, if you could throw a couple of takeouts, you know, from this, if you know, whether you're running a sporting organisation, a sporting team, whether you're running a corporate team, whether you're running a small business, just from a team and a leadership perspective, what's a couple of things you'd say, this is where you should start?
The first thing, I don't know why, but the first thing that comes to mind when you say that is weight of numbers. So that's a big thing that we throw in, WON, weight of numbers. I mean, if you've got more people in the organisation or in the team that are willing to lead and row the boat, the better you're going to be. So don't be afraid of that, trying to bring other people up, sit alongside. That would be the number one, weight of numbers. What else?
I like that idea of, you know, you call it the trademark, but it's whether it's standards or something like this, like have an anchor to keep coming back to.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And for us, that's, you know, I mean, the weighted numbers is, I guess, secondary to the trademark, because you need that first, and then you need everyone living and breathing it. So having that trademark or the set of values that you want the organisation to live by, and keeping it simple. those values. Something that you can just, it's not a matter of who's got more skill or who's smarter, but who's got the willingness to do it. And it just comes down to willingness, whether it's...
Well, you say simple, and I know that they evolve and change the, you know, those that trademark, but when you say hard, discipline, united, it's hard not to know what you're thinking and talking about. Like, you can explain hard to me, but I'm imagining it's on the field, it's every contest, it's every training session, it's everything you're doing, it's at a level of intensity or hardness that goes to it, a competitive part to it, right?
Yeah.
Like it's the simplicity of the word talks to it says volumes, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, well, for me it does, because it's been the way it has been for the last 13 years. Again, it's changed, it's developed, there's been senses that have... Effectively, it's pretty much been the same, but as different groups have come on and it's a little bit different now, it's ruthless, selfless, united. But again, the actions that underpin it are something that aren't necessarily related. They are related to game day, but they're related to how you approach your career. So, you know, I'm relentless in everything I do, meaning you're just going 100%. So when I started, it was hard, discipline, you know, hard was 100% effort 100% of the time.
Okay.
Now, whether that's possible or not, I don't think so.
Yeah.
But it's that just mindset of going, well, okay, I'm going to do this session here, but I'm going to have a crack. You know, I'm going to give it everything because that's what we do.
I remember setting an ideal week for a group once, like, this is what a week should look like. And I remember a couple of experienced people said, that'd be virtually impossible to be able to do it. And I said, that's the point. Yeah. Like, we're actually aiming for nirvana, and then if we miss, we're still having great weeks. You know, you don't have the ideal down here.
Correct.
Yeah. And so I like that idea of, 100% hard 100% of the time. But we know it's not possible to be 100% all the time, but that's what we're striving for. It's, again, that intent, right?
Yes, yeah.
So we have an idea of have a simple trademark that you can anchor to, live and breathe it every day. I love the weight of numbers when you talk about that idea of don't be afraid of having more leaders. The other bit that you touched on, which I think is maybe the good finisher, is that idea of prioritise time to review.
Absolutely. Right. Prioritise time to review and then be able to... reward the good behaviours, and put that up in lights in front of the whole organisation, however you do it, and keep an eye out for the opposite.
I love it. Josh, I've enjoyed that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.